This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I'll start by applauding the United States and all other donor countries, partners, and the private sector for supporting health sector in Africa. As I said, Africa carries between 50 to 70% of the burden of disease globally, but we only contribute less than 50% of the health budget in the continent.
That's Dr. Faustine Engelbert Ndugulile of Tanzania, who has been nominated to become the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa. He's talking about securing necessary funds and resources for WHO. Details coming up also. As the West clamps down on imports of green technology products from China, Beijing is looking for new markets. And Egypt reportedly delivered military aid to Somalia, a move likely to deepen strains between the two countries and Ethiopia. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Shortly before the show, I heard from Eric Kawa, a reporter in Brazzaville who is monitoring the World Health Organization Regional Committee for Africa's 74th session. I first asked Eric to tell us about the purpose of the meeting, who the participants are, and the key points on the agenda.
The WHO Regional Committee meeting in Brazzaville focuses on enhancing Africa's health leadership and, of course, looking at collective voice to actually achieve the Lusaka agenda. Now, the Lusaka agenda is one that is talking about health initiatives, building upon the future of these initiatives and processes that are aimed at improving effectiveness of global health initiatives in supporting country-led health priorities and universal health coverage. So the purpose of this meeting actually has to also do with reviewing and strategizing health policies and prioritizing the African continent. And there have been discussions about implementation of the Lusaka agenda and, of course, the implications for global health initiatives such as that of the Gavi, the Global Fund, and the Global Financing Facility. And participants actually came from different countries here talking about delegation. It includes health ministers from different countries and stakeholders from global health initiatives and partnerships that are also including that of the RBM partnership to end malaria, which is the road map to actually end malaria project. So for the key points that have been discussed in the agenda so far, the regional health leadership has been discussed here that has to do with building up and ensuring that there's unity in pursuing this particular Lusaka agenda. And
we understand someone was nominated to become the regional director of WHO, and this is what Eric had to say about that.
Appointment of the WHO regional director is also a key highlight of this particular event, where Dr. Faustine Engelbert Ndugulile from Tanzania has been nominated to become the next WHO regional director for Africa, succeeding Dr. Matshidiso Moeti. And then his term is set to start in February of 2025. And Dr. Ndugulile has a background in health policy and community development, and he aims to work collaboratively with member states to address regional health challenges.
And lastly, I asked him about mpox, which is a major concern on the continent, and what is being said about that issue.
And definitely there are concerns about the mpox, which is also a key topic that has been looked into at this particular regional meeting. So for the RBM partnership to end malaria, this is also one key body that is working towards this malaria project, and they have stated and will be having a press conference tomorrow that will be addressing some of the issues around mpox and that of the malaria precisely. So they have stressed the need to increase funding to combat malaria and to address related health disparities. The partnership also has emphasized that malaria is unacceptable justice, according to them, I quote, due to its impact on African health systems and economies, and they're also advocating for some multi-sectoral approach to tackle the disease effectively. So overall, the meeting has actually served as a platform for setting the regional health priorities.
That was Eric Kawa reporting from Brazil. Brazzaville. As you just heard, Dr. Faustin Engelbert Ndugulile of Tanzania has been nominated to become the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa. My colleague from VOA's French service, Mohamedou Houmfa, interviewed him shortly before delegates at the WHO Africa Region meeting elected him to be the nominee for the post. In this excerpt of their conversation, they start by discussing the shortage of healthcare professionals in many African countries.
It's true that Africa is facing a human resource challenge, and nearly all the countries have a shortage of human resources. But when you look at these challenges, they are related to production of human resource per hub. There are challenges that are related to recruitment. There are challenges that are related to retention, and the challenges that are related to motivation of health workers. Each country in the African continent has a story to tell. So there's no one-glove-fits-all approach to this matter. We need to take it into context, look at each African countries and put that into context, ensure that we provide tailor-made solution for each member state. But I do acknowledge we have a problem, but we need to look at it more broadly and address the specific needs and issues within each and every country in the continent.
One last question before we end this interview. What do you expect from countries like the United States, whose contributions are significant in the international and global health system?
Well, I'll start by applauding the United States and all other donor countries, partners, and the private sector for supporting the health sector in Africa. As I said, Africa carries between 50 to 70% of the burden of disease globally, but we only contribute less than 50% of the health budget in the continent. I believe that we need to do more. And my appeal is for the African countries to continue doing more. Yes, we need the US and the other donor countries to continue supporting while we are still finding our feet as a continent. But we are seeing that with increased global economic hardships and wars, we are seeing resources that being directed to health diminishing or being diverted elsewhere. So it's also time for us as a continent to start thinking seriously how we increase our domestic financing towards the health sector. I believe that investing in health, we are going to have a healthier Africa, more productive workforce, to develop our economies.
That was Dr. Faustin Engelbert Ndugulile of Tanzania speaking with my colleague Mohamedou Houmfa. The WHO Executive Board will formally appoint the new Africa Regional Director when it meets next February. As the West clamps down on imports of green technology products from China, the world's biggest manufacturer is looking for new markets. Kate Bartlett spoke to analysts who say the topic is likely to dominate the agenda of the upcoming Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit.
Held every 3 years, the 2024 FOCAC Summit will be the first since China reopened after the pandemic and suffered an economic slowdown. The meeting of leaders is also happening amid growing geopolitical rivalry between Beijing and the West. Clifford Boyer is an analyst with the Pretoria-based China Global South Project.
As a global power competition intensifies and we're seeing a widening gap between China, the US and the West, I expect in this forum China to try and consolidate ideological and political alliance with the continent.
China is the largest producer of solar panels in the world and in 2023 accounted for 3/4 of global investment in overall green technology manufacturing, according to data from the International Energy Agency. However, China has overproduced and is now facing a mismatch in supply and demand for its glut of products. The US and EU, keen to protect their own manufacturing and jobs, have enacted protectionist policies, increasing tariffs on products from China, including electric vehicles, batteries, solar panels, and critical minerals. Mboya again.
We see that Chinese products are increasingly facing tariff restrictions in the US and Europe. And I believe China will be looking for alternative markets in Africa.
In exchange, African leaders will be looking to reduce a long-standing trade imbalance and for China to take more of their exports, he said. While many African countries, some of which are facing energy crises, will welcome help with their transition to renewables, Paul Nanchila, a research associate for the Africa Center of Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., explained China also benefits greatly.
If you look at the green growth, for instance, the technology which is marketed to African countries, which African countries have to buy either through loan finance or directly through commercial entities, that's one way in which China benefits.
Since the pandemic, China has been shifting the priorities of its global infrastructure building project, the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, to what it has dubbed the Green BRI. Other topics up for discussion at this FOCAC will include agricultural modernization, information technology, and education and training. African leaders will also be looking to get a one-on-one with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Switzerland organized 10 days of discussions in Geneva on ways to ensure a humanitarian cessation of hostilities in Sudan. But military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who boycotted the meeting, blamed the American envoy for Sudan for imposing the agenda of the meeting and rejected the participation of the United Arab Emirates in the process. The military leader also vowed to continue fighting the rival paramilitary rapid support forces, even, I quote, if it takes 100 years. Ambassador J. Peters Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
First and foremost, the objective of a ceasefire is first and foremost the question of the humanitarian crisis that Sudan faces. This is a country of 50 million people, but half of them face acute hunger. It's the largest displaced persons crisis on the planet at the moment. 10 million people have fled their homes. 8 million are internally displaced. 2 million have cross the borders of Sudan to their neighbors. Half of these displaced are children. It's a tragedy, and it has to stop. And the international community needs to do what it is necessary to both incentivize the warring parties to participate in these talks and to disincentivize spoilers. And I'm afraid that, you know, invitations are one thing, but we have to have some teeth behind them to force these people who are fighting to not only cease, but also to come to negotiations. This is not a time for grandstanding. This is a time for getting something done for the people of Sudan.
The military leader also vowed to continue fighting the rapid support force, even if it takes 100 years. And he dismissed any possibility of dialogue with the RSF leader, Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, and he also accused the United Arab Emirates of actively conspiring against Sudan by supporting the RSF. What's the best way to deal with Burhan's defiant stance?
Well, I think this is where real pressure needs to be brought. He has several weaknesses, least of which is the fact that he's isolated. He's been forced to effectively abandon the capital, Khartoum. The so-called government that he heads is holed up in Port Sudan. It doesn't require that much. And they've just, you know, in the last, you know, 24, 48 hours, we've seen an additional tragedy. Port Sudan has lost most of its water supply when the Arbat Dam collapsed. And so he's vulnerable. And I think we need to exploit that in order to force him to negotiations. We shouldn't leave him free to set his own terms any more than Hameti on the other side should be free. You know, the RSF, or whatever else one can say about them, they've at least shown up and joined the other parties in conversation the last week and some.
Following such an active role of the U.S., the African Union, and regional players in Geneva, what else can the international community do to find a resolution for this conflict?
I think pressure needs to be brought on both sides to participate in an honest, good faith negotiation. We're not going to solve all the issues, but the very minimum, what we need to do is ensure humanitarian access and to the desperate people of Sudan. Now, there's been some steps taken. The Sudan Armed Forces have finally opened after several months the Arbor border crossing with Chad and allowed some relief into Sudan. That's a positive step that has to be acknowledged. But there's a lot more they can do. And there's certainly a lot more pressure that the international community can bring. And up to and including sanctions, financial pressure, and others to bear. And I think all those tools in the diplomatic toolkit need to be employed to ensure that these conversations continue. Because with one doesn't negotiate with one's friends, one negotiates with those one needs to accomplish things. And for the sake of the people of Sudan, for the 10,000 children a day who are newly displaced, we've got to do something.
That was Ambassador J. Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Immigration is one of the top issues for U.S. voters this November as they decide who will occupy the White House. The difference in policy between the two presidential candidates is stark. VOA senior Washington correspondent Caroline Presutu begins our story at a dusty desert stop in Arizona.
This was a gold mining town, the richest strike in the state of Arizona at the time.
Now a ghost town.
Yeah.
Patty Burris lives here with Vino, her 38-year-old donkey.
Come here, buddy. There you go.
Burris says she's tired of undocumented migrants sneaking across her land from the Mexican border. Former President Donald Trump gets her vote.
He's going to deport them. Yes, I am all for that. Absolutely. Get them out of here. And he can do it. He knows how.
While President Donald Trump ordered that a 740-kilometer wall be built at the U.S. southwestern border, this is the Arizona part of it. On his first day in office, Joe Biden paused any new construction.
He could have had it completed in 3 weeks. But
Donald Trump returned to an Arizona border wall last Thursday, although the Washington Post reports the section he visited was built before he became president.
Because there's never been a border in the whole world that's leaked like this border with all those millions and millions of criminals coming through.
Democratic voters at their convention say their party is more tolerant. Sandra Cano moved from Colombia to the U.S. as a teenager.
Immigrants, we belong, the neighbors, we take care of each other. That's really what it's all about.
If elected, Vice President Kamala Harris promises a path to citizenship and the return of a bipartisan immigration bill that died in Congress.
The Border Patrol endorsed it. But Donald Trump believes a border deal would hurt his campaign. So he ordered his allies in Congress to kill the deal.
Back at the ghost town.
So Harris would not control the border as much.
Don't believe a word she says. Where's she been in the last 4 years?
Nobody stops by the old deserted town much anymore. Burris says she'd like to go back to the time when she saw more tourists come through than migrants. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Pierce, Arizona.
24-year-old Idi Amaru Jabiru says he always dreamed of one day carving out his path to the Paris 2024 Paralympic Games, which opens today, and his amputated left arm was no obstacle. VOA Africa reporter Birumi Balima has the young athlete's story from Niamey, Niger, narrated by Omari Kasiko.
Ide Omaru Jabiros grew up mimicking other martial arts athletes, but never imagined practicing martial arts like most young boys his age. He still believed in his heart that one day he will carve out his own path to the Paralympic Games. Now he's looking forward to participating in this year's Paris 2024 Paralympic Games, taking place from August 28 to September 8 in Paris. Jabiro says he believed his grandfather, who kept telling him to not see his amputated left arm as an obstacle. Jabiro says he didn't think he could do it because of his disability, but his grandfather, a taekwondo enthusiast, encouraged him.
When I was little, I liked playing football. It's football that I like the most. When I competed for the first time outside, it was in Turkey. People thought I was there because of football. Now, it's taekwondo that has taken over.
His mother's uncle, Mahamadou Sole, who Jabiro refers to as his grandfather, says he saw something special in him. His grandfather, Mahamadou Sole, says ever since Jabiro was little, he knew that he was going to achieve something great, and he never hesitated to tell him that. The 24-year-old athlete has already made history as the first Paralympic athlete from Niger to compete in para-taekwondo, which debuted as a Paralympic game in Tokyo 2020. He attributes his success to his grandfather, who was his first coach. He calls him Papa Cho, a reference to Niger's Olympic coach, Grandmaster Hyong Ko Cho. Jabiro says he was 20 years old when he first started training, and his first coach was his grandfather, Mohamedou Sole. Sole would spend hours with Jabiro every day, teaching him the right techniques.
There are many people who helped me get to this point. The first person is Papa Cho, the first one who encouraged me to do taekwondo, and my two coaches.
His father, Ide Omaro, says Jabiro's discipline is remarkable. Jabiro's father, Ide Omaro, says he's confident that Ide will excel because he has worked hard to reach this level, alongside studying as a second-year agronomy student at Abdo Momoni University in Niamey. Jabiro's coach, Abdurrahman Isakayao, says he qualified in the K44 men's 70-kilogram category, which includes athletes with unilateral arm amputation or equivalent loss of function or loss of toes. The disability affects the ability to lift the heel properly, but Jabiro is not letting his disability limit him. His coach, Abdurrahman Isakayao, says he has high hopes that Jabiro will return triumphant. Jabiro says he couldn't contain his excitement the moment he realized he could take his dream to the world stage. Jabiro says the day he found out he qualified for the Olympics was one of the happiest days of his life, but that he also realized he had a big responsibility toward his family and his country. Back home in Niger, Jabiro's family checks on him daily, keeping his spirits up as he prepares to compete and challenge perceptions about differently abled athletes. Jabiro's mother, Rakia Lawali, has faith that her son will win.
We have nothing to offer him but innovation for him to succeed in life.
Jabiro's participation in the Paris 2024 Paralympics Games will be closely followed by his fans. As a young Nigerian with a disability to engage in sports and compete internationally, Jabiro's achievement is a source of pride for his family and his country. For Borehima Balima in Niamey, Niger, this is Omari Kaseko, VOA Africa.
And in more news from the continent, Egypt delivered its first military aid to Somalia in more than four decades on Tuesday. Three diplomatic and Somali government sources said a move likely to deepen strains between the two countries and Ethiopia. An unidentified diplomat told Reuters that Somalia was playing with fire by importing the Egyptian arms and antagonizing Ethiopia. Somalia and Egypt's foreign ministers and a spokesperson for the Ethiopian government did not immediately comment. Egypt and Somalia have drawn closer this year after Ethiopia signed the preliminary deal with the breakaway region of Somaliland to lease coastal land in exchange for possible recognition of its independence from Somalia. The Mogadishu government has called the deal an assault on its sovereignty and said it will block it by all means necessary. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.